In a very real sense, I think that our program today is interrelated with this theme. It's concerned with freedom. It's concerned with freedom to live a long and a healthy and a good life. And it's concerned with justice in terms of what we do to ourselves, how we treat ourselves medically and physically and mentally. A couple of weeks ago, on the last Open Mind program, in fact, we did a program on John Kenneth Galbraith's new book, The Affluent Society. And The Affluent Society, again, is, again, in part, a theme of ours today. We want to talk about medical research, what we do with ourselves, how we treat ourselves, how we seek to find in a society that is concerned with luxury, how we seek longevity. And so, concerning the matter of long life and medical research, this is our topic today. As a matter of fact, we were stimulated in large part to this topic by a magnificent book that has been put out, a magnificent pamphlet by the National Health Education Committee. It's called Do We Spend Enough Dollars to Defend Our Lives Through Medical Research? I think quite clearly that the answer is no, but this booklet describes the, or details the answer, tells about the millions and hundreds of millions and billions that we spend in other directions and about how very little we spend on medical research in our society. I think now that I'd like to introduce my guests who are going to join me in this discussion of the affluent society and medical research. My first guest is Senator Richard Neuberger. Senator Neuberger is a Democrat for the state of Oregon. My second guest is Dr. Nathan S. Klein, Director of Research at Rockland State Hospital here in New York. My third guest is Mr. Gilbert Kant, who is the medicine editor of Time Magazine. Well, gentlemen, I think that it may not be quite fair. I've been tooting our horn about winning the Sherwood Award. I think it may not be fair, Senator Neuberger, to quote a man's wife, not necessarily against him, but to begin a program. But I noticed in an article that you wrote, and incidentally the title was Crash Program for Health, that at the very end you say, I still recall what my wife Maureen said to me when she was fighting for a paltry $80,000 in the Oregon legislature to spend in behalf of retarded little children. And then you quoted her. She said, the beasts of the field on my mother's farm will do anything for their young. Can we look the next generation of human beings in the face if we have not done everything possible for them in this vital area of sound bodies and medical care? And I guess the question that I would begin with, because in a very real sense it's a puzzling one, you represent the people, you're selected by them. How do you explain their reluctance to care for their young as the creatures in the barnyard do?
Well, Mr. Hefner, I don't think the people have any reluctance. I think it's up to people in positions of political leadership, such as myself, the foundation you've just mentioned, people like Dr. Klein in medicine, like you and Mr. Kant in the field of public opinion, to give the people leadership. I think that they will respond. In my opinion, the field of medical research is our greatest frontier of today. I come from Oregon, a frontier state. I've read how in covered wagon days, the incidence or the coming down of epidemics of diphtheria, scarlet fever, and smallpox meant death, hopeless death to hundreds of people, including many little children. And we cluck with pity and sympathy over that. I wonder if 50 years from now, people won't mutter with sympathy and pity over the hopelessness of cancer in our own period today. And so I believe the people will respond to the need for support of medical research if those of us on this program and others like us give the people the leadership and the information they need.
You mean you think it's just a matter of stimulating what basically is a public willingness to spend this kind of money?
I do not think there is any public reluctance to support medical research if they have the facts, the information, and the leadership. That's my opinion.
Well, we haven't done it up to now, and as a matter of fact, I was going to ask Dr. Klein, not as a research scientist, as director of research at Rockland State, but rather as a psychiatrist. Let me not be cute about it, because I'm deadly serious about this. Why, psychiatrically speaking, haven't we done this? Do you think it's just a matter of public information?
Well, in part that, I think there's also a tradition which we inherit in our culture that suffering is somehow the retribution for sin, and since a good deal of culture is built on repression and guilt of necessity, they are not necessarily bad things if they're used constructively, but we still inherit the tradition that if someone suffers, that somehow or other they are paying for some fancied or real guilt that they have. In the history of medicine, this is certainly true. When anesthesia was first introduced just about 100 years ago, there was much objection to this on the grounds that woman was born to suffer, particularly during childbirth, so that this was raised as an objection to a medical advance. So that I think in part when we relieve ourselves of discomfort, we almost feel guilty about enjoying good health.
Now, I'm afraid that just as a layman, and then I'd ask you, Mr. Kant, as the other layperson here to comment on this, I just feel that it's hard to explain this, Senator Neuberger, in terms of public information. I think I'm a pretty typical layman and well enough aware of the dangers of these diseases.
I think there's an historical thing here, and I'm not an historian in the same sense that you are.
You mean an historical block?
Yes. I'm more concerned with current affairs, but we have to remember that the first really conscious care of other creatures, I think, began with the domestication of cattle some 10 or 12 or 15,000 years ago, however many it was. And those are creatures that you can observe and you can see what your different procedures do, what effects they have. The medical treatment of fellow human beings has been a hit-and-miss thing, hit or miss, mostly hit and miss, right up until the last 100 years or so. It wouldn't have done any good for 200 years after Harvey discovered the circulation of the blood in, what was it, 1860-something, roughly. 1660-something, I'm sorry. It wouldn't have done any good for 200 years after that for somebody to give 100 million pounds a year, as it would have been in those days, even on this side of the ocean for research, because nobody knew would have known what to do with it. The only thing that was found by accident a little over 100 years later when digitalis was found, and that was from an old wives' remedy. The same thing is true about microbes that cause infectious diseases. For 150 years after Leeuwenhoek discovered the microbes, nobody knew anything about what they had to do with disease until Pasteur worked on it. Now I think what we have is an historical lag as well as an historical block, but now at last we have this knowledge, and we haven't quite convinced all of ourselves of it. We haven't quite got cranked up to go.
I might add that in a book called Aubrey's Brief Lives, which was somewhat the equivalent of Pepys' Diary, Aubrey, who knew Harvey, has a very interesting comment, quoting Harvey, that when his book on the circulation of the blood came out, I can quote this verbatim because I was impressed, his practice did fall off mightily, and the vulgar thought him crack-brained. So that I think your point is well
taken. You think this refers to our investigators today, too?
I'm just commenting.
Well, you know, Mr. Hefner, I again want to emphasize why I'm optimistic about the support of medical research. There are groups such as the one you mentioned, the National Health Education Committee. There are leading doctors, people in public opinion, pushing on this. Let me just cite what I mean. When I first came to the United States Senate in 1955, the National Cancer Institute, which is part of our National Institutes of Health, where most of the government support of medical research is centered and where the grants are made, the National Cancer Institute had only $21 million annually. The United States Senate last week authorized $81 million for the National Cancer Institute. Few fields of government appropriations have gone up so much proportionately. Now, during this next week, the Senate appropriation of $81 million must be considered with the much lesser House appropriation of $57 million and adjusted in conference. And if the viewers on this program and the listeners on this program want to really do something specific, they should write to their senators and their congressmen to support the Senate appropriation of $81 million for the National Cancer Institute and of the same proportionately larger funds for the National Heart Institute, the National Mental Health Institute, the National Dental Institute, and so forth. But just look, in the 3 years since I came to the Senate, the fund for the National Cancer Institute has gone up, by Senate authorization at least, four times nearly. Now, I think that's encouraging. I know my constituents in Oregon support it, and I'll wager that the people in New York support it, in Ohio, and all the other states.
Well,
that's my feeling.
Mr. Hefner?
Yes, Mr. Kent.
Somebody has to be devil's advocate here. Let me be it, if I may. Let me nominate myself. I would like to know, perhaps from Dr. Klein, how nearly can you equate simply increased appropriations for these things with increased results, better results, meaning very useful discoveries in actual terms of health and treatment?
I would say at the present time that Certainly there is a quite direct correlation. If we ever reach a society in which researchers can absorb all the money that's given to them, then you run into a law of diminishing returns.
Well, the reason I ask this question is because some people contend that there is such a scarcity of technically trained people that the appropriations can increase, profitably be increased, roughly only in the same proportion as the population growth or your graduating classes from the science schools.
Well, there are two answers to that. One, that there are no places that I know of, no research institutes, and I know a fair number that feel that they have as much money as they can usefully put into good research, so that we're not near that point at all. The second, you may look ahead to the fact that someday there may be such a place, but the fact that positions are available, funds are available for research, stimulates people to go into the field. One of the great difficulties in research until really only a few years ago is that a researcher was automatically considered a man who was willing to work for less money than, let's take the medical field, than the janitor, or certainly very much less than his clinical colleague. So that it's only since the stimulation in part from our Russian competitors that research and science have achieved some respectability. And Mr. Connor, who is the president of one of the pharmaceutical houses, Merck Sharp and Dohme, it came out with a very interesting speculation that if we wanted to run competition with the Russians, let's have competition on the field of health or longevity.
Too practical a suggestion.
in support of what Dr. Klein has said, one of the funds that we have authorized in the Senate for the third year is for the NIH, National Institutes of Health, to make grants for the construction of medical research facilities. I'm particularly interested in that because the University of Oregon Medical School wants to construct a medical research building. That fund has been oversubscribed 5 or 6 times every year by perfectly legitimate, authorized, and screened requests from private clinics, from drug manufacturers, and particularly from medical schools. So that indicates that there is need for these funds and for wider medical support and wider governmental support. And I think the answer about the government doing it is this. Can you go down to the drugstore and buy your own cancer research or heart research? Of course you can't. The only way you can really do it properly is as a taxpayer through the U.S. Public Health Service and other skilled and talented and knowledgeable government channels to make these grants, such as I've pointed out, for medical research facilities, for medical schools, for medical training, and for the most extensive kind of research. Because in the field of cancer research, while I'm not an expert on it, and Mr. Kant or Dr. Klein could correct me, it's my understanding that while there are no breakthrough has been made, we are on the frontier of something with advances in chemotherapy which do show promise of getting at the causes of this sinister disease. Isn't that correct?
I would correct that to say that we are on several frontiers simultaneously, not only the frontier of Oregon, but of Washington and points.
But I think it's interesting to note that in this booklet put out by the National Health Education Committee, they say that the drug industry itself, you're talking about government, Senator Neuberger, and they say the drug industry has spent 7.3% of its total income, which is many, many, many times the percentage that other industries spend for research on research.
And for which they deserve credit.
Yeah, well, now you're saying that you can't go to the drugstore and get your own cancer research cure.
I might point out one thing in here, Mr. Hefner, with
Dr. Pond.
What you can go to the drugstore with, which is, to me, very interesting. I never realized the figures that we spend in this country for other items. You can go to the corner and buy your chewing gum, of which there are $296 million worth sold in 1956. Alcoholic beverages cost something like $11 billion, which to me is just staggering when the sums we're talking about here for support of research.
Yes, but here you're not talking about what government is spending, and maybe this is the important thing. You're talking about the public. You're talking about us. And if we were smoking at this minute, we'd be involved in this, too.
No, but by far the bulk of the money spent for medical research comes through government sources. It's my understanding that the rest of it is relatively small. For example, the American Cancer Society collects maybe $30 million, and a great deal of that has to be spent for the treatment of indigent cases which otherwise would just die in agony and untreated. and that the funds made available through the National Institutes of Health, it's my understanding, is by far the bulk of the money spent on medical research in this country now. Is that right
true.
Or wrong?
That is true, but it's extremely difficult to establish just how much money actually goes for the kind of research we're talking about. We can't possibly set ourselves up here now as certified public accountants and break down these figures. But when a drug company says it spends so many $100,000 on research, some of that is product research. It is not pure research, basic research, and it isn't all of it, even this intermediate kind of research where you have a chemical that looks as though it might be something and you start trying it out in guinea pigs to see whether... A lot of these are problems of bookkeeping. This is something incidental to Dr. Klein that I've discussed with Mr. Connor, whom you mentioned. We can't get absolutely sharp answers. It so happens that in my job, we love to be able to say 1 billion, 863 million, and so on, right down to the fraction of a cent was spent in a year on so-and-so. We can't do it. The general answer, I think, is that roughly two-thirds of all money used for the medical research of the kind we're all talking about does come from the federal government. Incidentally, of course, when I posed as devil's advocate here, I was never suggesting for one moment that Dr. Klein's Rockland State Hospital would ever have enough money or could ever possibly have too much. We know it can't.
Well, what about...
But I think we come back to this historical thing. Until recently, it didn't seem as though it did any good. Now, only in the last roughly 20 years since the sulfur drugs came across from Germany, is it clear that in one area after another we can do good? The same pamphlet from this committee that you mentioned lists the things that we have done in the last 20 years. It is now clear that if we lay out this money, we can do a lot of good with it, and especially if we lay it out on a long-range program. And that's something I'd like to ask Dr. Klein about, the advantage of the long-range program.
Yes, this is a tremendous problem in the field of research because most support, except in a fortunate situation such as ours where the state of New York has underwritten such a program, is on a yearly basis. And this makes for a good deal of insecurity if a man takes a job and has no guarantee that it'll last more than a year.
And this was the point that Senator Newberg was making before.
I think we have to have the same sense of urgency about the war, if you want to call it that, against cancer and heart disease and these other maladies that plague the human race that we have for our military appropriations. For example, when the Appropriations Committee is having hearings, time and again, high officers in the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy say, gentlemen, unless you provide this fund, I cannot accept responsibility for the security of the United States. And it seems to me you have to have the same urgency on the part of the doctors that come before us and the other technically qualified people in behalf of funds for the NIH. And just say, gentlemen, it seems to me that we should explore every single possible avenue, no matter how remote, no matter how far-fetched, that might lead to a breakthrough in the field of cancer and heart disease and so on. And only the government has the kind of funds for that. And it seems to me that the American people, if I assess public opinion correctly, want to spend their tax money for that purposes. I've had lots of grumbling about taxes, but never about that spent for the National Institutes of Health.
Yes, but you say, you make that point, Senator Neuberger, but you also, and you also said before, that the appropriations for the National Institutes have increased. They've just about doubled or more.
More than that.
More than doubled.
Four times, if with the Senate fund sticks during the next few weeks, four times for the National Cancer Institute in the 3 years I've been a senator.
If everybody listening writes in, they'll make the Senate appropriation, which is larger, prevail.
Correct.
All right,
I hope they do.
But what about this question? You say in an article that I've read recently by you that your neighbor in Washington is Mr. Shealy, who was Surgeon General.
Until recently, when he retired.
All right. You put the question to him. To combat cancer, how much money could you spend, could you take, could you use constructively? And his answer was $500 million a year. Now, you're talking about $500 million on the one hand, and now you're talking about $80 million if the Senate prevails tomorrow or the next day.
But we are making progress toward that goal. And I want to say that Dr. Shealy thought of that in the terms that Mr. Kant expressed as a continuing appropriation to be used as fast as there were the medical researchers, the medical schools, the private clinics, and the private laboratories to use it. And we are advancing toward that goal all the time. And I think relatively soon we will make available every dollar that can be spent. Because I think public opinion wants this type of appropriation.
But you see, I think one of the troubles is, and maybe Mr. Kent would comment on this, that with something as dramatic as the Salk vaccine, I think a good many of us felt that here was an instance where some one thing happened, and I don't think we feel about it in the way that you describe. You gentlemen all talk about putting money into research in many, many different ways, a fundamental research, a fundamental program that will lead to medical schools and lead to making research a more and more attractive field. But I think that for many of us, we felt that the Salk vaccine will just happen like that, and that here there was a need for a certain amount of money for research, and when the research was finished, it was finished. And I think that maybe you've got to do more of a job of education.
Mr. Hefner, I would like to comment on that, because if that is the impression that many of our viewers have, they have terribly short memories. Because I happen to have worked on the very first fundraising program for what was that year called the President's Birthday Ball. It was the first one staged by Basil O'Connor and his group for President Roosevelt's birthday back in 1934, it would be, the beginning of 34. And that, of course, has grown into a tremendous annual March of Dimes thing. And I have forgotten, and I didn't do my homework for this program, exactly how many dimes it is, but I think the last figure I used was 2 billion dimes, which is $200 million, have gone into research. And that began roughly 20 years ago. Again, you can't get a precise date. This was money that came from the people, Senator, in the form of their dimes and their half dollars.
Well, I would stress that.
I think this is very important. It so happens, this is the open mind. Let me express an opinion that may not be universally popular. The National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis has been criticized for over-dramatizing polio, for being too aggressive in its fundraising, and perhaps for making polio, which was a comparatively rare disease and comparatively rarely kill people, though it did have this dreadful paralyzing effect. They've been criticized for making that appear in the minds of the public as a more urgent medical problem than cancer or heart disease. Well, I don't think they should be criticized for that. Oh, perhaps in some detail, yes. But in general, that foundation showed what can be done with money and determination and with all the differences of opinion. And I've had some with Mr. O'Connor himself and with other people. With all these differences of opinion, it is still true that they did absolutely basic research. They spent money for research that didn't look as though it had anything to do with polio, but eventually it paid off. And they did a tremendous, undramatic screening job to find out just how many different kinds of poliovirus there are. That job took years. It involved three of the biggest university laboratories where they have specialists in viruses, including Dr. Salk's.
But when it was done, it seemed to have been done,
they had the money for a sort of crash program for two reasons. This, incidentally, is one of the places where I disagree. I think they crashed it 1 year too fast. But they had the money from their own resources, and they could get money from drug companies which were going to manufacture the vaccine. And they were set to go. Now, other organizations are trying to do the same thing. And just one little note on this. Let us never forget that the American Heart Association was the first one to introduce lifetime grants to researchers, giving them $30,000 a year for life, out of which they can get, I should say, roughly half as salary, and the other half roughly for laboratory expenses and so on. This is a very valuable thing.
I would add two things on Mr. Kahn's comments. One is that medical advances in one field always represent an advance in another field. That is, research done in polio contributes to research in all other areas. The second thing is that certainly the will of the people would seem to be very strongly, as Senator Neuberger has pointed out, to support this. He's never criticized for supporting a bill of this type. And there are more and more awareness of the importance of medical research. In my own field, I'm connected with an organization, RISE, which is specifically for research in mental disease rather than clinical services. And although it's just been incorporated, the funds have come in without solicitation. So that I think that the will of the people is overwhelmingly to do something about it, and it needs leadership.
Despite the guilt?
Perhaps because of it.
Well, you know, I think that, Mr. Hefner, the very fact that Mr. Kent emphasized what was achieved in the field of polio dramatizes the great frontier ahead, which I began by emphasizing earlier on the program. In the last year before the Salk vaccine was developed, Polio, despite its terrible crippling effects, as outlined by Mr. Kant, killed only 579 people, only 579 children under the age of 14. And yet cancer last year killed nearly 4,000 children, I think 37 or 3,800 below the age of 14. And it's still the greatest killer of children except accidents, although we think of it as a disease of old age. And it seems to me the frontier ahead of us is so great that only the government can handle the bulk of the problem. Now, I don't mean that private contributions, the private laboratories cannot make great strides in this field, but I believe that the NIH appropriations are still at the core of our chance of getting through and making a breakthrough in the field of cancer and heart. I think
I would concur. I think that is true, but I don't think we can ignore the roughly one-third, which I believe is private money or corporate money. An interesting thing came up this past week. I was in San Francisco covering the annual convention of the American Medical Association for Time magazine, and I think the most interesting scientific paper that I came across there was one by Dr. Wendell Stanley of the University of California on the possible relationships between viruses and cancer. He was not claiming to have all the answers. He was presenting a theory. This is a theory which we are now pretty well equipped to do a lot of work on because of what you're talking about. Most of these cancers in children are the so-called blood cancers, leukemia, which may be connected with the virus. We have enough information now, using the experience of the Polio Foundation, to spend a lot of money along the areas, along the lines that he suggests.
May I just suggest that our time is up and we better hope that industry, government, and the public all spend that money and accomplish the research that has to be accomplished. We'll be back in 2 weeks on The Open Mind with the subject Talent, Excellence, and the Affluent Society. Next week, The Reason Why, with Ben Grauer interviewing District Attorney Edward Silva. We'll see you in 2 weeks.